isn't a movie, but a series of overexposed snapshots. Blackness is crowding in on me. Blink, blink, black. And then there are arms around me before I can collapse to the cobblestones below, helping me to a nearby bench. The blackness in front of my eyes is dissipating. Had I seriously gone into this thing promising not to be a weirdo fanboy and finished off fainting because Stephen King shook my hand and signed my book? Well, Kev, all signs point toward yes. Then George Beam is there, and Stu Tinker, and Roy Robbins from Bad Moon Books crowding around and verifying that I'm okay. Sure. Yes. Completely okay. 59. The Dark Half, 1989. I'm indebted to the late Richard Bachman for his help and inspiration. This book could not have been written without him. Stephen King, author's note, The Dark Half. When Richard Bachman died unexpectedly in 1985, no one figured he'd come back from the grave, but he did. You can't keep a good man down. He posthumously published The Regulators in 1996 and Blaze in 2007. Bachman also signed the limited edition of The Regulators, but in an unorthodox fashion. Faux checks bearing his signature were glued in the book itself. In The Dark Half, King draws on the real-world circumstances surrounding the revelation of the Bachman pen name. He crafts a story that, like Misery and the Tommyknockers, deals with the nature of creativity and writing and what happens when they violently collide. In Misery, Paul Sheldon deliberately kills off a popular fictional character, Misery Chastain, to prevent writing more romance novels about her. And in The Tommyknockers, an alien intelligence is at work, substantially transforming through a process known as becoming, a writer named Bobby Anderson. In The Dark Half, Thad Beaumont's cover as George Stark is blown by an inquisitive creepazoid named Frederick Clausen, who forces Thad's hand. Clausen, even his name is suggestive, works to unearth the connection between Thad and his pen name. He places invasive phone calls to people in the publishing industry and takes a trip to the post office in Brewer to stake out Thad's mailbox for surveillance purposes, finally getting what he wants. Incontrovertible proof that Beaumont and Stark are one and the same. He then contacts Beaumont to request an assistance package, a blatant ham-handed attempt at blackmail. As Thad Beaumont's wife explains, when a genuine creepazoid gets his teeth in you, he doesn't let go until he's bitten out a big chunk. Clausen meets an untimely end at the hands of George Stark himself, Thad's pen name that comes roaring back to life and goes on a murder rampage. Publishers Weekly praised the novel, calling it so wondrously frightening that mesmerized readers won't be able to fault the master for reusing a premise that puts both Misery and The Dark Half among the best of his voluminous work. Collings expanding on the Publishers Weekly review in the Stephen King Companion fills in the much-needed details. In this marginally autobiographically inspired horror tale, King touches on inner fears that are intimately related to the external horrors his readers have come to expect, if not demand. Almost obscured by the creatures, supernatural, science fictional, and other, populating the pages of It, The Tommyknockers, and Misery, is yet another species of creature that finally emerges in The Dark Half, to command full attention. The Dark Half anatomizes the complexity of creative imagination, merging King's experiences with his own pseudonym Run Wild, as witnessed by the continuing collecting mania for Bachman books, with thoughtful discussions of creativity and responsibility, of artistic integrity, of the destructive and regenerative powers of fiction, all without losing the essential sense of story. In the Bachman books, King wrote that The Dark Half is a book my wife has always hated, perhaps because, for Thad Beaumont, the dream of being a writer overwhelms the reality of being a man. For Thad, delusive thinking overtakes rationality completely, with horrible consequences. 60. The Stand, The Complete and Uncut Edition, 1990. So here is The Stand, constant reader, as its author originally intended for it to roll out of the showroom. All its chrome is now intact, for better or for worse. And the final reason for presenting this version is the simplest. Although it has never been my favorite novel, it is the one people who like my books seem to like the most. Stephen King, Part 2 of Preface in Two Parts, The Stand, The Complete and Uncut Edition. 12 years before the uncut version was published with illustrations, The Stand was published sans illustrations and significantly truncated in wordage. As with The Lord of the Rings, whose fans complained that it was too short, a view also held by its author, J.R.R. Tolkien, The Stand's fans also complained that they wanted more. Much more than what they had been given for a first serving. They wanted what was kept back in the kitchen. This second serving adds 150,000 words to the original text, updates the time frame from the 80s to the 90s, adds a new beginning and ending, and is illustrated with a dozen Bernie Wrightson pen and ink illustrations. Accounts differ as to why the cuts were made. On one hand, King writes in The Stand, The Complete and Uncut Edition, that the reason was not an editorial one. If that had been the case, I would be content to let the book live its life and die its eventual death as it was originally published. Doubleday, however, saw things differently. As stated in the Science Fiction Chronicle, King's editor at that time, William G. Thompson, who is now a freelance editor, says he edited the manuscript strictly for editorial reasons. "There was no pressure on me to cut it because it was too big," Thompson told the New York Times. However, Thompson was fired by Doubleday before The Stand went into production, and according to King, Doubleday's publisher, Samuel S. Vaughan, told him that the book would have to be cut even more to keep the retail price down. Vaughan, now a senior VP and editor at Random House, says, "Steve has always made me the heavy in the story. It's the book that was heavy. By trying to keep the price down so that it was not prohibitive, we were trying to build the career and sales of a young author." The consensus among King fans, at least, is that his numerous additions to the primary text, the updates, and the other changes deepen an already rich novel. The fans who wanted more text got their wish. In short, The Complete and Uncut Edition quickly replaced the original version as the edition of choice among his fans. Michael Collings enumerated the changes. The 1990 version also incorporates far more detail concerning the spread and the devastation of the superflu. The alterations range from single-paragraph vignettes, frightening in their simplicity and in King's ability to sketch plausible characters in a minimum of space, to near chapters designed to enrich the novel's portraits of social dissociation. These restorations establish more plausibly the survivors' reactions to the new world the superflu has created. Each of the restorations and changes strengthens the novel. King was not satisfied to merely reconstruct the novel as he had originally envisioned it. He also carefully revised the entire manuscript to bring it up to date for the 1990s readers. This often includes changing or adding such details as the names of songs and singing groups, fleeting political and social allusions, and brand name references more immediately recognizable to later audiences. The fantasy elements intrude into the science fictional framework much sooner, diminishing the sense that the novel begins as post-apocalypse science fiction, and then about halfway through, abruptly introduces the fantastical elements of dreams and portents, prophets and prophecy. the greater emphasis on the superflu and its consequences makes the transition from extrapolation to mysticism more believable. In this respect, it is significant that most of the changes, especially those relating to characterization, setting, backgrounds, and atmosphere, occur early in the book. In either of its manifestations, The Stand is one of King's strongest novels. It is a consistent, readable, teachable response to life in a frighteningly technology-oriented world. It also reminds us that we may sometimes be forced to find a place for the spiritual and the supernatural within that world. The restored novel confirms King's position as a master storyteller, and at the same time, it provides even readers familiar with all of his works to date increasing insight into the growth and transformation over more than a decade of his abilities, his themes, and his narrative power. 61. Stephen King draws on Bernie Wrightson to illustrate The Stand. Significantly, unlike the original version, the revised edition of The Stand was illustrated with pen and ink artwork commissioned not by the publisher, but by Stephen King. Deciding that he wanted Wrightson and no other artist, King paid him out of his own pocket and told him to carefully wrap up the art and pack it away for safekeeping until the time came to publish them. Wrightson pocketed King's money, drew a dozen striking illustrations, packed up and stored the art, and turned his attention to other projects. 2 years later, King called with the surprising news that Wrightson would have to negotiate a fee with Doubleday for use of his art. Reminding King that he had already been paid, Wrightson was understandably puzzled. But King told him that what he had been previously paid amounted to a finder's fee. The rights, though, to publish the art would exact a separate cost payable by the publisher, who was contractually bound to include the art. King made it clear to Wrightson that Doubleday could not publish the book without Wrightson's art, so he should make sure to get paid a fair price. After a series of back-and-forth negotiations between Wrightson and Doubleday, they finally agreed on a fee. Had Wrightson forced the issue, he could have asked for significantly more money, but he did not, because he is a gentleman. As Wrightson explained to me, he had no interest in taking advantage of the situation and financially holding the publisher hostage. His only interest was in getting adequate compensation for a book that he knew would make its publishers millions of dollars. Wrightson was thankful for King's largesse. King had gone out of his way to make sure he took care of Wrightson in this matter. Wrightson knew that King was well within his rights to have claimed the art was paid for, to the point where King himself could have resold the rights to the publisher for a large sum and simply pocketed the money for himself. But from the start, King's strategy was to put money in Wrightson's pocket by subsidizing him in a way that the artist would find acceptable, not with an outright gift of money, but with an art fee the artist would negotiate with the publisher. Wrightson's 12 illustrations were rendered in pen and ink. Its first plate was a film noir piece depicting Larry after he put his sick mother to bed. Its last plate depicted Randall Flagg, the Dark Man, presenting himself as Russell Faraday as he lords it over a group of brown, smooth-skinned folk, simple folk. With his sharply defined portraits, sweeping landscapes, and freeze-frame shots of the novel's significant moments, Wrightson's cinematic art lends the right visual touch to King's epic novel. Artist and author working together, at the height of their artistic talent, to create a textual and visual work of wonder. I nearly jumped out of my skin. I have read every word King's ever published in book form. I love his stories. I love everything he does. He's one of the most accessible writers I've ever read. His voice just runs through every sentence, every paragraph, every page. It's like having him actually tell you a story. I have read a lot of Poe, Lovecraft, and Edgar Rice Burroughs, but I haven't read everything they have done as I have done with King. The first King book I read was The Shining. It had been out for about a year. I knew who Stephen King was because of the movie Carrie, but I hadn't read the book. I didn't even know about Salem's Lot. I was in Detroit, working on A Look Back, when Chris Saviza asked me, "Have you read any of this stuff by Stephen King?" He loaned me a copy of The Shining. I took it back to the hotel and started reading, and I was up reading until 4 in the morning. I was just exhausted, but I couldn't put it down. I was in a dismal little motel room. The light was out in the bathroom. And when I got to the scene with the woman in room 217, I was scared to death to go into my darkened bathroom. Then someone in the next room threw something against the wall when I was reading that scene, and I jumped out of my bed. I nearly jumped out of my skin. I've always loved horror stories, but there aren't too many guys whose books have scared me. The Shining is one of them. I always freeze up a bit when I'm illustrating Stephen King. My idea of an illustrator is to be a servant to the story and the writer's vision. I try to be a faithful interpreter. This opens up a lot of doors in my head. When I read a King story, I realize that everything that's happening in the story is set in the real world, not some fantasy world. I'm not reading a fantasy, a ghost story, or a horror story. King's world is so real, I'm afraid that the world I'm creating won't be as real as his. I would ultimately do a disservice to his story if I get something wrong. Bernie Wrightson, Interview, Knowing Darkness, Artists Inspired by Stephen King. 62. A Dark Treasure, The Limited Edition of The Stand. Dedicating the novel to his wife, Tabby, Stephen King called the book This Dark Chest of Wonders. He also described The Stand as a long tale of dark Christianity, and the limited edition's design plays off both motifs. The limited edition of 1,250 copies, issued at $325, resembles either a dark chest or a red velvet-lined black casket, depending on your viewpoint. Regardless, the limited edition stands as the most collectible and most desirable limited edition of any King book. Designed by Peter Schneider, who is best known in the specialty book publishing field as a co-founder of Hill House, the signed limited edition of The Stand, the complete and uncut edition, is a stark contrast to the uninspired production values of the previously published Doubleday editions, including The Stand in its 1978 edition, which King singled out in interviews as being a fat, ugly brick. In contrast, the limited edition is a bar of gold bullion. Doubleday spared no expense in publishing this limited edition. In fact, making a profit wasn't an issue, as it always must be for a specialty press. Doubleday's exceptionally high production values meant that the final bill for the book and its custom-made box probably covered costs but didn't generate a big profit. The idea, clearly, was to give fans a limited edition that would be, like the family Bible, an heirloom to be passed down to the next generation. Doubleday, after all, could afford it. The costs of the limited were likely folded into the cost of the trade edition, which made millions of dollars for the publisher. The limited edition book itself is bound in authentic black leather, not leatherette, which is often used for limited editions to keep costs down. There is foil stamping in metallic gold and red on the leather boards. The book is printed on heavy, opaque, off-white interior paper stock. Two-color printing is used throughout for maximum visual effect. Red ink for ornamentation devices and black for the text. The gilt edges are in gold ink. The box itself is a work of art. It's a varnished wooden box painted in flat black paint, its case lined with red silk, like that of an expensive coffin. On top of the two-piece box, a brass plate identifies its content. The final touch. a sewn-in silk ribbon to facilitate book extraction. Not surprisingly, demand for this edition far exceeded supply. It was a feeding frenzy. Anxious fans besieged the publisher, offering up to $1,250 for a copy when it was first announced. Today, 24 years after its publication, the $325 book predictably commands a collector's price on the specialty market. Betts Books recently sold a copy for $1,850. Copies online range in price up to $2,500. If you are adamant about owning just one limited edition Stephen King book, get this one. It's always held its value and will always be in demand because it's the centerpiece of any King collection. Insofar as limited editions go, fan favorites include The Eyes of the Dragon, because it's from King's own press, Salem's Lot, because it's oversized and classically designed, and Skeleton Crew, with J.K. Potter's photo illustrations. But towering above them all is The Stand, the complete and uncut edition. For diehard King fans, it's the book of choice in terms of its popularity, its production values, and its investment potential. Stephen King on Limited Editions. From The Politics of Limited Editions. Castle Rock, July 1985. A real limited edition, far from being an expensive autograph stapled to a novel, is a treasure. And like all treasures do, it transforms the responsible owner into a caretaker. And being a caretaker of something as fragile and easily destroyed as ideas and images is not a bad thing, but a good one. And so is the re-evaluation of what books are what they do that necessary follows. 63. Michael Collings on Four Past Midnight, 1990. As with Different Seasons, which shares the overriding time metaphor both in its title and in the arrangement of its stories, each of the four tales in Four Past Midnight is virtually novel length. Each approaches the art of writing from different directions. Each seems to belong to slightly different genres, and ultimately each varies in quality and evocative power. The Langoliers, for example, shows the quintessential King at his best, spinning a tale of fantasy and horror. In what readers will recognize as vintage Twilight Zone fashion, characters discover that something has happened, and worse, that something unknown and indefinable is coming, threatening the eventual disintegration of everything, perhaps including time itself. King's images of diminishing solidity, of worn-out matter, and of encroaching nothingness that is the Langoliers remain long after the story is over. Secret Window, Secret Garden, on the other hand, belongs to a sequence of stories that anatomize the writer's imagination, and that includes Misery, The Tommyknockers, and The Dark Half. If Thad Beaumont is haunted by a murderous pseudonym, Morton Rainey is pursued by the specter of plagiarism personified in his greatest creation, a character so vivid that he actually did become real. The Library Policeman, like so many of King's finer shorter works, parallel psychic horrors with the deeper, darker horrors of real life. And, simply put, any horror story that depends for its climax on combining a variation on Heinleinian puppet masters with a wad of bullseye red licorice squashed on the railroad tracks deserves to be read. The Sun Dog provides a narrative link between The Dark Half and Needful Things. In spite of the fact that the sun in question is a Polaroid camera, a needful thing, as it were, for young Kevin Delavan, King quickly connects that common, everyday object with an encroaching supernatural horror. In this story, King's penchant for detail at times overwhelms his storytelling, so several pages, for example, are devoted to the relatively insignificant task of buying a roll of film. Similarly, when the Polaroid begins to develop and show something, the sun dog, moving inexorably closer to the barrier separating its world and ours, the story slows almost to a halt. One of the few tales that seem longer than required, it nevertheless prepared readers for what is to come in Needful Things. Responses to the stories will vary with each reader, of course. Arguments as to which of the stories is the best will likely depend as much on the readers as on the stories. Of the four, however, The Sun Dog seems the weakest, particularly because it illustrates King's occasional need for careful, stringent editing. Secret Window, Secret Garden, on the other hand, with its probing of diseased psychological states, resonates well with the earlier novels. Although none of the stories carries the weight and focus of Rita Hayworth and Shawshank Redemption, in King's earlier quartet of tales, and arguably among his better performances, Four Past Midnight nevertheless demonstrates once again King's unusual versatility and range of vision. 64. Rock Bottom Remainders. I love rock and roll, but writing is not like being a rock and roll star. I think a lot of writers in my generation are closet rock and roll freaks. I don't think there's ever been a survey done of this, that you would find a lot of closet air guitar players who know all the Eric Clapton solos and that sort of thing. So when I write, I just crank the music. I inundate myself in rock and roll, and it kind of poisons the atmosphere around me so that people don't approach me, unless they really, really want to get close. You know, "Steve, the house is burning down," that kind of thing. Stephen King, in an interview promoting BMG's video recording of the first RBR concert. As Kathy Kamen Goldmark explained, in the fine rock and roll tradition, the Rock Bottom Remainders were conceived in a car. As a semi-pro musician with a day job in book publicity, I spent a lot of time driving touring authors around San Francisco. I decided to form a band of authors. On May 25th, 1992, the Rock Bottom Remainders made their first and second public appearances for booksellers. The first was billed as the Rock Bottom Remainders Unplugged, in which the band members appeared on stage in the grand ballroom of the Disneyland Hotel, where they sang two songs a cappella at Garrison Keillor's A Celebration for Free Expression, an evening of censored classics. The second appearance later that night was when they kicked out the jams. They plugged in guitars and cranked up the volume on their amps at a nearby club, the Cowboy Boogie. You had to be there. I was. I wanted to be down on the floor buying the autographed t-shirts, photos, and other memorabilia that raised money for three charities, including the Homeless Writers Coalition of Los Angeles, or dancing like crazy. But instead, I was on a raised platform packed with other photographers who tinkered with their film cameras, wondering about their camera settings because the light level was low and constantly changing. So, how was the music? Not important. So, how much fun did everyone have? Man, it was a blast, in every sense of the word. That place was rocking with traditionally sedate booksellers who got out on the dance floor and kicked it up. They turned out to be a pretty lively bunch. What made it all the more remarkable was that the band members weren't trained musicians. They were baby boomers who harbored daydreams of playing rock and roll in a band. They turned off their word processors to turn on the music and the audience, and had fun doing it, too. The Day the Music Died. When Kathy Kamen Goldmark passed on in 2012, the band members felt it was time to move on. As Stephen King, one of the original members, noted, things just didn't seem the same afterward. Her death took the wind out of the band's sails. The last concert, two decades after the first one, was for the members of the American Library Association, also in Anaheim. Playing for fun, the Rock Bottom Remainders raised the roof on stage, and in the process also raised $2 million for charity. For the band members, it was a rare opportunity to get away from their day jobs get together to jam with other authors, and have a little fun just hanging out after hours and in between gigs. It did take a while for the band to get their act together. As recounted by Dave Barry in Midlife Confidential, the Rock Bottom Remainders tour America with three chords and an attitude. Ringer Al Cooper listened to the first rehearsal and offered helpful suggestions like, "Don't play so loud," "Don't play at all," and "I don't think we should do this song." It was all in good fun. Here's a great moment, recalled by Dave Barry, when they were playing at a concert in Los Angeles. "I picked up one of the two guitars I'd been using, and just as we were about to start, Stephen King tapped me on the shoulder and said, 'We have a special guest.' I turned around, and there was Bruce Springsteen. I still don't know how he came to be at this convention. I don't believe he's a bookseller. All I know is he was picking up the other guitar. My guitar. 'Bruce,' I said to him, 'do you know the guitar part to Gloria?'" This is like asking James Michener if he knows how to write his name. Yesterday. I was there, as I said, at the first two public appearances. When they toured, and when I had the time and opportunity, I got to a few more of their gigs. At one, in New York City, I remember seeing Neil Gaiman invited on stage by Stephen King to play the harmonica. And there was also a concert in Bangor, Maine, when King broke into a wide grin when he saw Warren Zevon play the guitar behind his head, a moment I was glad I caught on camera. Sadly, Zevon passed away in 2003. I remember that concert because a good friend of mine, the late Charlie Freed, with whom I had driven up from Connecticut, had paid for tickets for dozens of local teenagers who otherwise couldn't afford to attend. Charlie had the biggest heart of anyone I've ever known. And today, the reunion. You can't keep a good band down, though. And some of the remaining band members still wanted to rock and roll. So, at the Tucson Festival of Books, March 14th and 15th, 2015, Amy Tan, Mitch Albom, Dave Barry, Scott Turow, Ridley Pearson, Ray Blount Jr., Alan Zweibel, and Greg Iles plugged in, tuned up, and rocked on. As Barry commented to the local media before the concert, "Play is probably a strong term for what we do with our instruments, but we have them with us on stage for sure. I would say a better term is we hold our own instruments." But it wasn't the same without Stephen and still the King there, who has unplugged for good. The day King fans noted, the music died. In Stephen King's The Neighborhood of the Beast from Midlife Confidential, King wrote, "Playing music again, playing for an actual audience after all those years was fun. Well, actually, it was a little more than fun. It had to have been, or the Three Chords and an Attitude tour never would have gotten off the ground. It was, in fact, exhilarating. Now that's music to anyone's ears." 65. Quotes by and about the Rock Bottom Remainders. Quotes by the band. Solo. Dave, his mind may be full of boogers and dog poop, but his heart is full of love, Barry, guitar and vocals. "We play music as well as Metallica writes novels." Michael, whoever heard of a man named Doris, percussion. "And so the remainders played, 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 played. It was a sound to hear and to forget." Essay in Midlife Confidential, 1994. Robert, but then I forgot it all in grade school, Folgum. Mandocello, guitar, and vocals. "Anyhow, we're in this hotel, and this maid comes in, and she keeps looking at me, and she smiled, and she said, 'I know who you are.' And I said, 'No, you don't. Who am I?' And she said, 'You're Kenny Rogers.' And, of course, I said, 'No, no, no.' And she said, 'If you were Kenny Rogers, you wouldn't say you were Kenny Rogers, would you? So you must be Kenny Rogers.' So that evening, I'm walking along with my guitars going to the elevator, and she went up like a skyrocket. See? I knew you were Kenny Rogers. So I signed her card, Love and Kisses, Kenny Rogers. Linda Richards, January Magazine, date not listed. Kathy, the queen of the book tour, Goldmark, bandmother and remainderette vocals. I realized that I had a lineup of band members simply from the folks I was driving around. So one day I asked Dave and Barbara and Amy and a few others if they'd consider doing a rock show to raise money for charity. They said yes. When Stephen King came on board, things really took off. Hope Katz Gibbs, meet the leader of the band. BeIncandescent.com, April 2011. Matt, happy families are all alike, graining, Critics' Chorus. People are throwing panties at you. They certainly never do that at my book signings. General Attribution. Stephen and still the King, guitar and vocals, on their final concert after 20 years. Since I've been on this tour, a lot of people have come up to me and said, "You guys don't sound too bad, but don't quit the day job yet." As if I'd quit my fucking day job. I like my day job. Carlin Romano, Philly.com, 1993. I'm looking forward to reuniting with all my bandmates. Some of us can remember all of the words. All of us can remember some of the words, but none of us can remember all of the music. That's why they call it rock and roll. Marquee.blogs.cnn.com. Barbara, she may be the answer to Stephen, Kingsolver. Keyboard and vocals. We really thought it was a one-time thing. We didn't count on this vampire syndrome. We're kind of thinking about doing something new, like maybe a professional hockey team. Carlin Romano, Philly.com, 1993. Al, he may be a mother you-know-what, but we all call him Dad Cooper. Keyboard and guitar. On when the band members found their musical legs. This time we're so much better because everybody really did their homework. We picked the songs via fax, and everyone really practiced hard. So when we came to rehearsal, it was like, we're actually really playing music this time. Carlin Romano, Philly.com, 1993. Grail, Elvis is dead in my books, Marcus, Critics' Chorus. The idea of a tour, a heroic barnstorm down the East Coast, Massachusetts to Florida, just a happy-go-lucky troupe of crazy scribblers with their repertoire of sock hop tearjerkers and frat house drinking songs, struck me as utter lunacy. All but criminal hubris, the indulgence of infantile fantasies of mastery and sexiness by those less wise than I. I figured the jig would be up by the third gig at the latest. From The Bosnian Connection, Midlife Confidential, 1994. Dave, I'll say fuck the police if I want to, Marsh, Critics' Corner. I never intended to become known for cross-dressing. Yet, this is how I will be best recalled. Appearing during rock and roll's ultimate teen death fantasy, Teen Angel, while wearing a hideous transvestite getup, stalking Stephen King from beyond the grave into the wilds of imagination, covered in taffeta and fake blood. Name of the chapter? Broadway Chapter. Midlife Confidential, 1994. Ridley, he do know Diddley Pearson. Bass and vocals. With the reserve lights on our fuel tanks, we were by day too close to empty. But not at curtain time. We became, in our own small way, professionals. We took it on the road, and it worked. Every show was sold out. Every performance earned an enthusiastic encore. Cujo meets the Booger Man, The Rehearsals, Midlife Confidential, 1994. Joel, if you rearrange his name, it spells Nelvis Selvin, Critics' Chorus. All along the way, our fellow members of the press evidenced zero interest in the Critics' Chorus. Dave Barry, yes. Amy Tan, maybe. But as long as Steve King was available, everybody was happy. Stephen King, others killed in crash, went the joke on the tour bus. The Critics' Chorus, Midlife Confidential, 1994. Amy, if you can't stand the heat, get out of my kitchen, tan. Remain Durette, vocals. We've chosen comedic songs for me, so it's part of the act that I don't remember my lyrics. The songs are These Boots Are Made for Walking and Leader of the Pack. I wear costumes for both. For boots, I'm especially gifted. I wield a whip, and at the end of the song, I tell the boys to bend over. The audience somehow forgets that I'm not a good singer, and they go wild. Noah Charney, The Daily Beast, 2013. Acoustic feedback. Entertainment Tonight reporter who couldn't find the big-name writers before a Rock Bottom Remainders concert to Tad Bartimus. Where's Dave Barry? Where's King or Tan? Where are the real authors? Chain of Fools, Midlife Confidential, 1994. Metallica, Kirk Hammett. Rock Bottom Remainders? Who the hell are they? General Attribution. Bruce Springsteen, after playing in concert in Los Angeles with them. Your band's not too bad. It's not too good, either. Don't let it get any better, otherwise you'll just be another lousy garage band. General Attribution. Tabitha King. Somebody had to do photographs for the RBR tour. Since I was going along anyway, and had been seen working a camera at the rehearsal for the Anaheim ABA show, I was asked to do it. Let's get it right out front. I didn't get paid enough. I didn't get paid enough. Midlife Confidential. Stephen King. I usually play chords on a word processor, which is a very private thing. It was great. It was a lot of fun. If nothing else, at least I've improved my guitar skills. Bangor Daily News, 1992. To an interviewer for Walden Books when asked if there's a career he'd like to pursue. Yes, I'd like to play rock and roll. I play an adequate rhythm guitar, but I'm not very versatile, so I guess I'll stay with writing. I kind of like it. Dave Barry. Recently, I played lead guitar in a rock band, and the rhythm guitarist was, not that I wish to drop names, Stephen King, from his newspaper article, The Great Literary Band, If You Can't Play It Well, Play It Loud. Diane Donovan, on their first concert. Were they any good, these rock and roll wannabes who gamely camped their way through a generous sampling of 60s singles? Well, they probably sang better than most rock musicians can write, and with a good deal more enthusiasm. Bolstered by three real musicians, ear-splitting amplification, and a wildly supportive crowd of more than 1,000 booksellers and publishing types, the Rock Bottoms put on a good show. Stephen King dominated center stage with his almost preternatural sex appeal, matching chords with Ridley Pearson and Dave Barry, who apparently hasn't changed a bit since 1965. Writers rock at Benefit for Literacy. Chicago Tribune, May 27, 1992. 66. Needful Things, 1991. I'll never leave Maine behind, King told Publishers Weekly, January 24, 1991. But Castle Rock became more and more real to me. It got to the point where I could draw maps of the place. On the one hand, it was a welcoming place to write about. But there is a downside to that. You become complacent. You begin to accept boundaries. The familiarity of the place discourages risks. So I am burning my bridges and destroying the town. It's all gone. Kaput. It's sad, but it had to be done. Taking the name of the town from a child's fortification in William Golding's The Lord of the Flies, Castle Rock is now forever linked to King. In interviews over the years, King said that home is where you know where all the roads go. In King's case, he knows where all the roads go in Castle Rock. He has reiterated, however, that the town had become too familiar, as he did at a press conference at the American Booksellers Association convention in New York City in June 1991. It's easy to dig yourself a rut and furnish it. I've done that a little bit in Castle Rock. Going back to Castle Rock for me has been like going home and slipping into an old smoking jacket or an old pair of blue jeans and settling down. After a while, I started to feel excessively comfortable in Castle Rock. I don't think that's a good state for a novelist to be in, particularly if you're in my situation and you've sold a lot of books. Let's face it, when you become extremely popular and you command extremely big bucks, bloat sets in no matter what you do. I'm just trying to postpone it as long as possible. Needful Things received mixed reviews, leaning toward the positive side. Publishers Weekly, enthusing about the book, wrote, King bids a magnificent farewell to the fictional main town where much of his previous work has been set. Of grand proportion, the novel ranks with King's best in both plot and characterization. King, like Leland Gaunt, knows just what his customers want. The Voices of Unreason. On the negative side, in the New York Times, Joe Queenan gleefully took a whiz on the novel. Yes, the maestro of the macabre, the czar of the zany, the sultan of shock, the liege of loathsomeness, is back with another of his gruesome novels, this time bidding farewell to Castle Rock, Maine, the site of so much mayhem in his previous books. If the plot sounds a tad adolescent, well, it is. Needful Things is not the sort of book that one can readily recommend to the dilettante, to the dabbler, or anyone with a reasonable-sized brain. It is the type of book that can be enjoyed only by longtime aficionados of the genre, people who probably have a lot of black t-shirts in their chest of drawers, and either have worn or have dreamed of wearing a baseball cap backward. Big, dumb, plodding, and obvious, Mr. King's books are the literary equivalent of heavy metal. Queenan's purported review, which was in fact a hatchet job, is equally insulting to King's readers. But at this point in the game, such clueless remarks are par for the course, and King never responded. But when Professor Walter Kendrick of Fordham University attacked Needful Things in a review for the Washington Post, writing that King has spat in his readers' faces before, and they have lapped it up, King responded and called the review a combination of academic arrogance, elitism, and critical insularity, adding that the critical approach Kendrick took says more about his shortcomings as a reader than his subject's shortcomings as a writer. King also said, at one point in his Jeremiad, one cannot quite call it a review, Kendrick states that I have achieved my success as a popular writer over the bleeding bodies of reviewers who have pointed out my lack of moral vision and inability to deal with any concepts larger, say, than my own bank account. That is absolutely not true. I have never stepped over a bleeding reviewer in my life. I have stepped over a few who were bleating, however, as I now intend to do with Kendrick. The Voice of Reason. Another academic, Michael Collings, professor emeritus at Pepperdine University, offered a more balanced view. Collings, unlike Kendrick, had approached King with the benefit of having read all of King's published fiction and written several books about King for Starmont House. Collings' take on Needful Things stands in stark contrast to the book's detractors, for whom attacking and insulting King's readers is standard operating procedure. He wrote, what would happen if a 20th century reincarnation of Mark Twain's Mysterious Stranger, or his equally discomforting Man That Corrupted Hadleyburg, decided to open a modest shop called Needful Things in the small New England town of Castle Rock and began selling dreams? Or at least what seemed to be the answers to dreams. In Needful Things, the result is a chain of initially superficial pranks that escalate into an unbroken and irrevocable sequence of interlocking horrors. By design, the actions in Needful Things culminate in King's starkest, most powerful confrontation to date of the dark powers and the white. Along the way, King touches upon and brings to final resolution the terrors and secrets revealed in earlier Castle Rock stories. The Dead Zone, Cujo, The Body, The Dark Half, with echoes of Christine, The Talisman, and The Tommyknockers, and opens his readers' imaginations to a place where love, belief, and magic tricks can fight evil to a draw. And by the end of Needful Things, he has also destroyed his most recognizable landscape, the haunted city of Castle Rock. If Needful Things, with its destruction of Castle Rock, represents a capstone to one specific segment of King's career, it is an appropriate one. The novel concludes with a sense of farewell, as readers take leave of a familiar landscape through a forceful, complex, and ultimately uplifting parable of good and evil, and the triumph of the good. Nearly a quarter century later, though, Castle Rock was center stage once again in a harrowing novel titled Revival, in which the lives of a young boy and a new young preacher who comes to town become intertwined with disastrous results. 67. Gerald's Game, 1992. Long before Anastasia Steele, a lip-biting virginal college co-ed, meets Mr. Christian Grey in 50 Shades of Grey, the games, that is, the bondage games, received fictional treatment, including in Stephen King's 1992 novel, Gerald's Game. It's Gerald's game, though, not his wife's, and she wasn't bound to be pleased. At the last minute, she decided not to have any part in his kinky bondage fantasy, and her well-placed kick below the belt to Gerald prompted his inelegant swan dive off the bed, resulting in his death. A change of scenery. With Castle Rock behind him, burning brightly like the town in Cary, like Salem's Lot, like the Overlook Hotel in The Shining, and like Las Vegas in The Stand, King turned his attention to exploring characters' interior landscapes in Gerald's Game and Insomnia. With the spotlight tightly focused on one room, Gerald's Game recalls Misery. The protagonist of Gerald's Game, Jessie Burlingame, is naked and has been handcuffed to a bed's headboard by her husband in their summer home, far from help, as she ponders her dilemma. Stephen King told Terry Gross of NPR that Gerald's Game started with the concept of a woman being chained to a bed, and I thought originally this was the takeoff point for the book. Wouldn't it be interesting to see what would happen if you had one character in a room? The question then became, what caused this woman to be in this room by herself? And the answer that I came up with was bondage. She's handcuffed to a bed. And that forced me to consider what causes people to do this sort of thing. And so once I'd set up the situation, I knew what it was going to be. I went in and read a little bit about it and thought a little bit about it. And the whole thing struck me as a little bit Victorian. There was something very Snidely Whiplash about the whole thing, and I tried to get that into the book. Over the years, Publishers Weekly has spoken positively of King's books, but this one gave them pause. While admitting that it's one of the best stories King has ever published, it noted that the gory stuff is prime King, but this is subsumed in the book's general tastelessness. A lame wrap-up to what might have been a thrilling short story only further compromises the enjoyment readers might have found in this surprisingly exploitative work. Publishers Weekly was not alone in its criticism. Responding to a reviewer's comment that Gerald's Game is more a mature fare because it avoids the monsters and the supernatural in favor of realism and social relevance, Michael Collings points out that the admiration is misplaced, that the novel was being admired for the wrong reasons. It is not that the story eschews horror, but that for the first time, Stephen King subordinates his story to a specific political or social agenda. Rather than making Gerald's Game King's first true masterpiece, however, the decision to do so undercuts his primary strength, that of storyteller, who along the way reveals important truths about human nature and social conventions. The plot of Gerald's Game is straightforward, almost blunt. Gerald Burlingame enjoys, if not requires, kinky sex games, including bondage. when he handcuffs his wife Jessie to the headboard of their bed in an isolated cabin near an equally isolated lake. She decides in a moment of feminist consciousness that she doesn't have to put up with such humiliation any longer. She demands to be released. Gerald assumes that she is responding to the game and comes on anyway. She kicks him in two strategic places, and Gerald dies of a heart attack, leaving Jessie handcuffed to the bed. For almost 250 pages, she tries to get loose. Then for the remaining 80 pages, she tries to adjust to post-Gerald life. In the end, Gerald's game seems more single-dimensional than one expects from King. Everything is neatly explained away, including Jessie's hallucinatory awareness that someone has been in the house with her. There seems little growth, little change. In important ways, she is still as handcuffed to herself and her past as she was handcuffed to her bed for most of the story. 68. Philtrum Press. We are, in other words, a very humble storefront in a world dominated by a few great glassy shopping malls. Stephen King, forenote to Don Robertson's The Ideal Genuine Man, Philtrum Press. In many ways, Philtrum Press shares much in common with other high-quality small presses. It's small in size, publishes infrequently, operates with a skeleton crew, and takes exquisite care in the manufacture and design of its publications. What makes Philtrum unique is that, unlike most small presses, funding is not a problem. The publisher, Stephen King, not only has deep pockets, but every publication offered for sale sells out immediately upon announcement. Moreover, the books are mostly his own, so it's self-publishing. The exception was Don Robertson's novel, The Ideal Genuine Man, about which King said he could not publish it. All of their publications to date have been designed by Michael Alpert, who is currently the director of the University of Maine Press. Alpert was one of the students in Burton Hatlin's writing workshop at the University of Maine at Orno, along with Stephen and Tabitha King. Also, all Philtrum Press's printed publications are now collector's items and long out of print. Philtrum Press publishes infrequently and maintains no mailing list. Its first publication was The Plant, in chapbook form. It's sort of an epistolary novel in progress, King said on The Larry King Show. A couple of years ago, I got to thinking about Christmas cards and how mass-produced they were. It didn't seem like a sincere, personal thing, so I thought, well, I'll do this little book and send it out to friends. What made all the chapbooks unique was that each was inscribed to its recipient. The three chapbooks, designed by Alpert, went out to friends and family. The small print run was 200 copies plus 26 lettered copies. Though The Plant was never completed, it's one that King's fans hope to see completed. Parts 1 to 6 are currently free in two PDF downloads on King's website. The plant is a present, Stephen King explained in Castle Rock. If I gave someone a coffee maker and they sold it at a yard sale, it wouldn't bother me. If they want to sell the plant, fine. It's theirs. They can tear out the pages and use them for toilet paper if that's what they feel like doing. For the record, I've never seen an inscribed copy for sale. Some that are sold may be printer's overruns. For the record, inscribed copies have gone up on the marketplace. Philtrum's backlist includes The Plant, Parts 1 to 6 in PDF, Parts 1 to 3 published as an ebook, 2000, The Eyes of the Dragon, 1984, a limited edition, signed and numbered hardback book, with slipcase, The Ideal Genuine Man, 1997, by Don Robertson. Six Stories, 1977. The New Lieutenant's Rap, 1999, with some copies distributed as keepsakes at a party in New York City on April 6, 1999, at the Tavern on the Green to celebrate King's silver anniversary in book publishing. Guns, 2013, an essay published in Kindle format, and as an audiobook. There's room in the Stephen King universe for his books that, like Dr. Sleep, sold over 900,000 copies in trade hardback, Publishers Weekly, just as there's room for small, elegant, self-published books with modest print runs, the kind Filtrum Press excels in publishing. 69. Nightmares and Dreamscapes, 1993. In King's lengthy introduction to this collection, totaling 816 pages in the trade hardback edition, he explains that there are some genuine curiosities in the volume, and concluded that it is an uneven Aladdin's cave of a book. In other words, it's a stew in which King serves up something for everyone's literary tastes. There's even a long nonfiction essay about Little League Baseball titled Head Down, that at first glance seems out of place. It doesn't really fit in a collection of stories which concern themselves mostly with suspense and the supernatural, except somehow it does, wrote King in his introduction. The value of this miscellany is its breadth. Trying to find the originally published versions of these stories would be time-consuming, expensive, and frustrating. The original sources variously include a newsletter for King fans only, mainstream magazines, original anthologies, specialty magazines, small press releases, and limited edition books. Dolan's Cadillac was serialized in 5 consecutive issues of Castle Rock, the Stephen King newsletter. Inspired by Poe's The Cask of Amontillado, King's updated version features a Cadillac. Note, if you are claustrophobic, you may want to avoid reading this story. It was then published as an expensive limited edition from Herb Yellin's Lord John Press, best known for its broadsides with handset type, chapbooks, and limited edition books. The Night Flyer appeared in an original anthology, Prime Evil, edited by Douglas E. Winter, a longtime King friend and author of Stephen King, The Art of Darkness. Chattery Teeth in Cemetery Dance magazine was published by the good folks at Cemetery Dance Publications, which issues more books by and about King for the specialty market than any other publisher. The Moving Finger appeared in a special issue of The Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction honoring King. Head Down came from The New Yorker magazine. My Pretty Pony was published by the Whitney Museum of American Art in what King correctly considered an overpriced and overdesigned edition. The limited edition run was composed of 280 copies, of which 150 were for sale for $2,200. The Knopf trade edition, at $50, was still overpriced for a short story, no matter how elaborate the final package. In King's opinion, My Pretty Pony gets the award for being a triumph of form over function. The design is wonky, the book is needlessly oversized considering that it's a short story, and it's heavy. The cover is brushed aluminum, with a liquid crystal display watch embedded on the front cover. As for the collection as a whole, Michael Collings points out, if there is a single flaw in Nightmares and Dreamscapes, it would be the lack of distinctive strength in the opening and closing selections. Dolan's Cadillac is a worthwhile story, but not on the same level among King's works as Skeleton Crew's The Mist. And putting Head Down, a prose piece on baseball, in the final position only underscores the lack of a powerhouse conclusion such as that provided by The Woman in the Room in Night Shift, and to an even greater extent by The Reach in Skeleton Crew. On the whole, Nightmares and Dreamscapes offers King's readers a great deal to sample and enjoy. In the last analysis, however, it does not meet, let alone exceed, the remarkable strength of Skeleton Crew. 70. Dolores Claiborne, 1993. Sometimes being a bitch is all a woman has to hold on to. Dolores Claiborne, from the film Dolores Claiborne. King fans can be divided into 2 camps, those who want only horror fiction and those who want everything he's written. Those in the former camp may be disappointed with Dolores Claiborne, but those in the latter camp are delighted. This one's a cooker. Following on the heels of Gerald's game, Dolores Claiborne is a poignant story about a woman with a justifiable tood honed to a sharp edge by a hard-scrabble life. For any reader who wants to see the texture of Maine life from an insider's perspective, this book delivers the goods. The title character is one of King's most fully realized and carefully drawn portraits. Dolores Claiborne is one of the most memorable in his cast of Maine characters. She's a straight-talking, no-nonsense, lifelong resident of Little Tall Island, and when she's talking, you'll sit up and pay attention. Longtime King fans will appreciate the map of Maine reproduced in the book, which depicts the locations of all his fictional towns. The book was also adapted as a major motion picture, released in 1995. Kathy Bates, who brilliantly acted her memorable role as Dolores Claiborne, was nominated for but did not win the following awards: the Chicago Film Critics Association Award, the Clotrudis Award, and the Saturn Award. To which I say, there ain't no justice in the universe. This is a near flawless novel, one that can stand on its own merits, though some have noted that it has a superfluous supernatural element that ties it to Gerald's game. Besides that minor caveat, the novel